Welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 15th of 1998, and in the Koinonia Fireside building this evening, we have Stephanie Paulsell. Her number today is 98.3, and the name of her session is The Creative Life and the Christian Life. Let's listen in.
How many of you just arrived? Welcome, welcome. It's wonderful to have you. This is the last session in a series on spirituality and creativity. We've been thinking the last couple of days about reading as a spiritual practice that helps us draw near to God and writing as a spiritual practice that helps us draw near to God. And tonight we're going to think more generally about the relationship between the creative life and the Christian life. I'll admit at the outset that it will be geared more toward writing than any other kind of creative work. So I hope that there are other artists and dancers and other kinds of creative people among us to help us think through other forms of creativity. Welcome. Seems to me over the course of this week, as I've been thinking with some of you about these issues, there seem to me two main ways that the Christian life and the creative life can be woven together or ought to be woven together. And one is that simply creative endeavors require a way of seeing and a quality of attention that's both deeply moral and deeply mystical at the same time. On Thursday, we looked at Sam Simon Bay, a 20th century writer who says that prayer consists of attention, it's the highest quality of attention that the human person can muster, and that even warmth of heart and the best of intentions can't make up for a lack of that kind of attention. She says that the kind of attention that's honed in doing mathematics or trying to learn another language is the same kind of attention that's needed to both to pray and to be present to our suffering neighbor. So we can't draw near to God or draw near to one another, really, without that kind of attention, which is a very difficult quality of attention to attain. I think we all agreed this week. Secondly, though, it seems to me that there's another relationship between the creative life and the Christian life, which is simply that the Christian life is a creative life. It has to be a creative life. We love a God that we can't see. We worship a God. We praise and adore a God who we can't tangibly touch. We seek that God in texts that are both beautiful and strange, that are both familiar and unfamiliar, that both, as Augustine taught us earlier this week, both veil God from us and help us draw near to God. So it seems to me that the life of the Christian is a life of creativity, because we're always having to imagine who God is, and we're always having to respond to this mysterious claim we feel in our lives from a presence that is not tangible to us. So with those two things in mind, what I'd like to do is just look at a few texts, short texts, by some Christian writers and some non-Christian writers about the creative life, and see if we come to any more conclusions about this relationship. If you have the packet, I apologize for not having enough of these. Our Xerox machine here, I think, is broken, and I've been giving these away during the week, so they've gotten fewer and fewer. If you'll look on page 7, The Creative Life and the Christian Life, section begins. And if you would skip the first reading to look instead at the second one, I think we'll start here in the Middle Ages. The second and the third readings are both from two women, both named Marguerite, both who died in 1310, but both who lived very different lives, as I'll try to describe. This first passage, number 2, is from the letters of a woman named Marguerite Doinct, whose name is at the bottom of it. It's a letter she wrote to a woman whose name we don't know, about a woman that she knew, and she may be talking about herself, or she may in fact be talking about somebody else, who, in the course of a sort of holy conversation with other men and women, hears the word vehemence being used. And this woman, like Marguerite Doinct herself, is someone very vulnerable to the power of words. who's very wounded by words, a person for whom words kind of get lodged in her heart and fester there and make her sick. So she hears this word vehement in this conversation, and she becomes obsessed with this word and tries to figure out what it means and asks other people, what does this word mean? And someone said, oh, it means strong, it means this, it means that. None of this helped. And she felt that she would, she got sick, and she felt that she would just lose her mind if she couldn't sort of dig this word out of the flesh of her heart. So she prays to God to teach her what the word means, and so relieve this horrible burden in her body. And this is, if you've been with me during the week, you know that for Marguerite, understanding and healing are very close together. That's how, for her, writing becomes a spiritual practice, because in figuring things out through writing, she's able to survive these very powerful experiences of God that she has and that make her sick and kind of leave her all wiped out. This woman prays to God for understanding and for healing from this word, and God responds with a vision. This woman seems to be in the middle of a desert looking at this tree. And the passage that I'll read to you in case you don't have it in front of you is what happens next. This tree had five branches on it, which were all dry and all inclined toward the ground. And on the leaves of the first branch was written sight, on the second was written hearing, on the third was written taste, on the fourth was written smell, on the fifth was written touch. On the top of the tree was a large circle like the bottom of a cask, so that the tree was all closed over in such a manner that neither the sun nor the dew was able to affect it. When she had gazed attentively at the tree, she raised her eyes towards the mountain and saw a great stream which descended with such great force that it seemed like a sea. This water rushed so very strongly to the foot of this tree that the roots were all turned upwards, and the top put itself into the earth, and the branches that had inclined toward the ground were all stretching towards the sky, and the leaves which were all dry were all green, and the roots which before were planted in the earth were all spread out and stretching towards the sky, and they were all green and full of leaves as branches are. Now that's a passage from this woman's letters, which I think is very much about the relationship between the creative life and the Christian life. And before I tell you what I think of it, I'd be very interested to hear what you make of this little story. I remember this is a vision that comes in response to a woman being wounded by her powerful reception of language. You know, she just receives language at full strength and is wiped out by it. And this is God's answer to her. What do you make of this story?
Well, it has the word attentively in it.
Yes, it does.
Gaze attentively, yeah. The first branch has sight written.
Yeah. Why do you think the five senses are inscribed into this tree?
Kind of like it's all the being.
Right, and it's engaging every part of her. And if you were here for when we were thinking about reading as a spiritual practice, Marguerite is a woman who tried to take the monastic practice of Lectio Divina, which is prayerful reading, which usually meant reading a text in Latin, either a biblical text or a text of the church fathers, and tried to expand that practice for women who didn't know Latin, so that they could read colors and they could read what their senses took in, and they could read their dreams and they could read their visions. So I think, yes, that's right, that this is encompassing all of her, that her creative life engages all of her senses. But even more, right? I mean, it's even beyond these five senses, that stream that rushes out of the mountain waters those branches and makes them green and enlivens all of her senses. But it also enlivens some other even deeper part of her, the creative part of her. She's a woman who, like many medieval women, felt she had to apologize almost every time she picked up a pen, you know. Before she, we know a lot about her writing practice, because whenever she sat down to write, she would say, of course, I'm just a woman, I really shouldn't be doing this, you'll have to excuse me, but, you know, here I am. And I think of that when I think of that, you know, cask on top of the tree that's keeping out the sun, and all of the things that, you know, for her, it's a culture that believes that women shouldn't preach and shouldn't write. For us, who are trying to be creative people in raising children or writing or dancing or creating art in some way, there may be other things that are keeping out the sun and the dew and the wind and the rain and all of those things that we need. But I think for her it was that prescription against women writing that is keeping out everything that this tree needs. Any other thoughts on this tree?
Well, I was struck by the fact that this stream just turned her whole life upside down.
Yes, right. The roots are in the sky and the branches are in the ground. And, yeah, it upends everything.
She wrote this?
She wrote this, yeah.
And she writes about herself in third person?
Well, but...
She's describing a person in her.
It's not clear. I mean, she probably is describing herself in the third person, but I also think when she does write about herself some in the first person, and I think when she writes in the third person, it's not to protect herself the way some women had to protect themselves. I think she's signaling us to not think so much about this autobiographically, but to make it a sort of didactic text.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very like her. I mean, when she writes about herself in the first person, she describes herself as a woman who experiences God as an author who writes in her heart. She thinks she'll get sick or die if she can't get God's writing out of her body. And so in response to God's text, she creates her own text. And comes up with an understanding of the creative life that I think is illustrated here in a more oblique manner of the relationship between God's creativity and her creativity as being bound up in one another. And she doesn't claim to rely solely on her own imagination, but she doesn't claim to be God's secretary either, you know, writing everything down. There's some third thing, I think, that she's trying to do. Well, we may come back to this tree, but let's press on so we don't run out of all this good stuff. Number three is also a text by a Marguerite who died in 1310, same as the first Marguerite, except the first Marguerite died of natural causes, a much beloved Carthusian prioress who appears later after her death to a bishop in the form of a bird, and she puts her beak in his mouth, and, you know, she's much beloved. This Marguerite dies at the stake in 1310. She wrote a book called The Mirror of Simple Souls, which she describes a little bit in the passage that we're going to read. And it's proclaimed a heretical text, and it's burned in her presence by the Bishop of Cambrai. And she's told, we're burning all the copies, you can't pass this book around. Well, she held some copies back and continued to pass them around. So she was arrested. The Inquisition attempted to question her, but she refused to speak at her trial. Her text is about what she calls annihilated souls who belong to God, and an annihilated soul has no use of language, you know. So she does not speak at her trial, and in the Inquisition documents, you can kind of see that they're really trying not to kill her. They're really trying to get her to speak, but she doesn't speak, and she dies. It's a really sad story. It's a really powerful story about a person with the courage of her convictions. But she, in writing her book, she tries to describe what it is she's trying to do in the passage that we're going to look at here. She writes, she's a very skilled writer, wrote in Old French, wrote in the vernacular, and she draws on the sort of courtly literature of her day and the themes and the tropes of that literature. So she writes her book as a dialogue between characters like love and the soul and, you know, these kinds of virtues that become personified. And in this section, love is speaking. And Love speaks about a woman who, like Marguerite Perret, longs for God but cannot get close enough to God. And so she writes this book in order to make God more present to herself. So let me just, this is rather short, let me just read this to you. This is Love speaking. There was once a young lady, the daughter of a king, of great heart and gentleness, and also of noble courage, and she lived in a foreign land. It came to pass that this young lady heard tell of the great courtliness and nobility of King Alexander, and soon her will loved him for the great renown of his kindness. But so far was this young lady from the great lord in whom she had put her love, for she could neither see him nor have him. But she was often disconsolate within herself, for no love except this one sufficed for her. And when she saw that this distant love, which was so near or inside her, was so far outside, she thought she would comfort her unhappiness by imagining some figure of her love, by whom she was often wounded in her heart. Then she had painted an image which represented the semblance of the king whom she loved as close as she could get to the presentation of how she loved him, in the affection of the love in which she was caught. And by means of this image, with her other practices, she dreamed the king himself. Now Marguerite Perret uses this passage, kind of plays on this story, which is a story she actually takes from literature, and retells it later in the book about the writing of her own book. And it's the same story. It's, I'm in love with this God who I cannot see and I can't touch. And so I'm going to make a picture as close as I know how of what this God must be like. And her picture is this book, which, to tell the truth, is really less about God and more about annihilated souls who live in God. But for her, it all gets very united, so hard to pick them apart. But I think, for me, what Marguerite Perret shows is how the life of faith is a life of creativity. The life of faith is a creative life, because so much is hidden. So much is beyond our sight and beyond language's ability to grasp it and describe it. Like all Christian writers who've tried to write about God from, you know, the beginning to now, she struggled with the dilemma of inexpressibility, mm-hmm. that God is always just on the other side of our language, that we can never quite get there. And she describes this this trying to imagine what God is like. Now she, if you take the two Marguerites, they're an interesting pair, not only because they have the same name and died in the same year, but because Marguerite Doynt really writes about God in order to keep a very present God at a kind of manageable distance. You know, God comes to her and writes on her, and she thinks she's going to lose her mind or die. And so she writes in order to kind of get that all under control and make it manageable. Marguerite Perret, on the other hand, writes in order to make a very distant God more present to her. And does claim, much more than Marguerite Doynt, to rely on her imagination. And I think this isn't one of the things the Inquisition calls her on, but I think it's underneath their critiques of her, you know, that that she did... You know, God isn't right in her heart. You know, she really brings this up out of herself in a way that she really lays claim to. And I think that is in part what gets her in trouble. But any comments or any questions about this strange Marguerite?
I guess what I was thinking of is she calls him the very best in herself,
yeah.
but she knows yeah. most intimately.
Yeah.
And as a tool, as a means to get to her God.
Right. That's right.
Each of us
That's right.
chooses that best,
That's
the most
right.
unique aspect of herself.
That's right.
To as a tool to get to her God.
That's right. That's absolutely right. That's really well said. She, and for her, that was both a source of her creativity, but also a source of great pain for her in an odd way, because for her, you know, to be an annihilated soul would be a soul whose will is is an island, basically. It's a soul with no will, a soul through whom God wills. And so everything, this is what got her in trouble with the Inquisition. You know, she would say things like, virtues, I have no need of you. But that wasn't because she wanted to be unvirtuous. It was because she believed that an annihilated soul would be empowered by God. And so an annihilated soul would never do anything against the virtues. But in order to write this book, she can't be an annihilated soul. Because an annihilated soul has no use of language. She embodies that much more at her trial when she won't speak. And she says this periodically as she's writing her book. She says, you know, I'm remaining mired in language because of my great desire to help other people, you know, come into this community of annihilated souls. And in order to, you know, offer this vision toward other people, I'm remaining in this, you know, low place in language. So I think that's exactly right. She was drawing on the best that she knew, on her great, obviously great knowledge of literature and marshalling all of that, but also feeling that that was impeding her spiritual progress in a way, but she was doing it on behalf of other people. So I think that's exactly right. Anybody else? This text has been translated by a woman named Ellen Babinski in the Paulus Press series, Classics of Western Spirituality. So if Marguerite Pritt interests you, it's a wonderful to look at, although it's very, very strange. Now, if we could back up to the first text in this section, this is by a 20th century writer named Kathleen Norris, who you probably know. She wrote the book Dakota and The Cloister Walk and most recently Amazing Grace, I believe. But this is an essay that she published in a journal called Plowshares. It's called Degenerates, and it really comes out of her viewing of an exhibit which you may have seen called Degenerate Art, which was art from the Nazi era, both art that the Nazis elevated and celebrated and art that they censored. And she, viewing this art exhibit, causes her to reflect on the relationship between liturgy and poetry and monasticism and poetry. And so this is one other way of trying to put together the creative life and the Christian life. And she's very explicit about the connections in this passage. She says, "What has surprised me in my time among monastic people is how much their liturgy feeds my poetry, and also how much correspondence I've found between monastic practice and the discipline of writing. Both writing and monasticism are vocations that require periods of apprenticeship and formation. They are not so much subjects to be mastered as ways of life that require continual conversion. For example, no matter how much I've written or published, I always return to the blank page, and even more importantly, from a monastic point of view, I return to the blankness within, the fears, laziness, and cowardice that without fail will mess up whatever I'm currently writing and in turn require me to revise it. The spiritual dimension of this process is humility. Both monasticism and poetry require attentive waiting. I think it's also a fair description of the writing process. Once when I was asked, what is the main thing a poet does? I was inspired to answer, we wait. A spark is struck, an event inscribed with a message, this is important, pay attention. And the poet scatters a few words like seeds in a notebook. Months or even years later, those words bear fruit. The process requires both discipline and commitment, and its gifts come from both preparedness and grace, or what writers have traditionally called inspiration. Both prayer and poetry begin deep within a person, beyond the reach of language. The 4th century desert monk St. Anthony said that perfect prayer was one you don't understand. Poets are used to discovering, years after a poem is written, what it's really about. And it's in the respect for the mystery and power of words that I find the most profound connections between the practice of writing and the monastic life." So that's a 20th century attempt to describe this relationship. It reminds me a lot of Marguerite Doink. Kathleen Norris talks a lot about what it's like to receive the language of Scripture in liturgy. And forgive me if I'm repeating this for those of you who are here on Tuesday, but she, in her book Dakota, she's got a wonderful section where she talks about having been away from the church for 20 years. When she returns, she's kind of blown away by the sheer power of the language that she hears in church. And she says, you know, what an amazing thing it is that, you know, on any Sunday morning, you can walk in for free, you know, into any church and hear this really strange stuff, really challenging stuff, read out loud, and you can receive it. And how countercultural that is. Where else, you know, do Americans gather to hear strange texts that challenge them and make a claim on them read out loud, except in church? So for her, the Christian practice of worship and gathering with the community to read and pray and sing these very, very powerful texts is very, very close to her life as a writer, has a lot in common with it, and indeed feeds it, as her later writing has proven. But she draws some nice connections here, that the creative life and the Christian life are both are made up of practices and disciplines that require formation and apprenticeship and waiting in patience and growth, that there are, you know, dry periods where you work and you work and you work, we talked about this on Thursday, and nothing happens, and your writing's not good and your prayer doesn't seem to be going anywhere. And then there are those moments of what she calls here inspiration that that you can partly prepare for, but that partly are God's work, you know, partly the grace of it. And so those are some of the connections that she draws between the creative life and Christian life. Does this ring true for you, those of you who are writers and artists and parents and lovers and spouses and all of the creative work that we're engaged in? Anything seem particularly true or particularly untrue? May I put you on the spot, because I heard you read that sonnet last night so wonderfully. Are you also a writer yourself?
I'm a writer who doesn't write right now.
Yeah.
It kind of chokes me up.
Yeah. But does this seem true to your own experience as a creative person?
Well, I was listening to what you were saying about the practice of worship and gathering, reading and sharing, how that feeds that, and wondering for myself if that feeds also the practice of waiting, which she spoke, and I think it must. I think it must for me. And my question for myself was, then can I let that feed the practice of faith in my own voice?
Right.
The part that I can relate to is the peers, laziness, and cowardice.
Yes, me too. That's the part I relate to. Yeah. And that's true. I mean, I think in, you know, our Christian life as well as our creative life. I mean, there are many days when being a Christian is kind of like sitting down at a blank page and having to overcome fears and cowardice and laziness and having to engage a waiting that may be very painful. And that may not feel fruitful always.
When she talks about the humility, it's humility that, that pulls us out of it and that we can belong, you know, when we give them to all the parts of us that create such angst. It's like I've got to remove my ego from it to become a blank slate mm-hmm. to receive the direction to seek to receive mm-hmm. God's word.
Marguerite Pratt would like that.
That blank slate. That's what she wanted to do.
No, I think that's right. I think that's a practice and a virtue that she's really, if you read her other stuff, I think she's really trying to work through figuring out how that relates to her life as a writer. Because to face the blank page, sometimes it is a huge act of the ego, right? I mean, it's hard to balance that, I think. And I think that's what Marguerite Doink knew every time she apologized for writing. That somehow she was claiming some ego, some power, some inspiration that maybe she's worried that maybe she shouldn't.
Yeah.
That her culture is worried that maybe she shouldn't. I think that's right.
It seems like the first writer felt the pressure of God.
Yeah, right. That's right.
And needed to use writing as a way to release that pressure or else.
That's right.
And then the second writer is, I mean, is she like most Christians in terms of having to, where God is distant,
yeah.
and we use certain tools, and yeah. that may be imagination or writing or reading, to create a presence of God in our lives. And then we have to, and the reason we don't do that is because of the cowardness and laziness, slothfulness, and such. I don't know too many Christians like the first.
Right.
And I met some in college. Right. And I stayed away from them. They were very different
yeah.
from the Christian who, like the second writer, had to, and we all have well imagined who God is.
I think that's a beautiful description of the two of them and the differences between the two of them. One of the things we talked about on Thursday was, in addition to this dilemma of inexpressibility, that we can never quite describe God, and in fact, we've come very far from being able to describe God truly, that the other problem that creative people have when they try to express God in their art is the problem of, well, it's this humility problem. It's the problem that it's the creature creating the creator, which in a way is what Marguerite Pratt is doing, right? I mean, she's the created one, and she's dreaming the king. She's, she creates this book in order to have, as you said, to create a sense of the presence of something that she can't see and can't get to, something whose presence she feels very much on the outside of. And I think, right, that's the daily struggle. I agree, I know many more people like that than I do. Those who feel that they're so overburdened by the presence of God that they have to write to resist it. Yeah. Janet, you were asking?
Did you have another reading you were going to discuss?
Yeah, I've got a couple more, but we got time to.
I wondered if I could read a poem.
I'll read a poem.
While you were in the staff meeting, we were talking about Rilke's poetry, and
yeah.
He writes in this book, Rilke's Book of Hours, which is not in the bookstore and should be, and I apologize for not ordering it sooner, but he has many poems about the making of poetry, and these are all prayers to God. So it's all about that relationship. And I was thinking about what you were saying about removing your ego from it. Well, I think there are some poets who kind of, I don't know how to describe this, and of course he does much better, but sort of work through their ego back to a sense of awe and humility,
right.
rather than saying, oh, not me, right? Because right. then they would get nowhere.
Because then you're silent.
Then
right.
you were silent.
Right.
This is what he says, and this won't make sense without my session, never mind. I think the people who talk are great, right?
Right.
You're here, okay. Anyway, the part I'm thinking of comes at the end of this poem, especially, but he addresses God as dear darkening ground. I mean the ground of being, sort of thing. Dear darkening ground, you've endured so patiently the walls we've built. Perhaps you'll give the cities one more hour and grant the churches and cloisters too. And those that labor, maybe you'll let their work rip them another 5 hours or seven before you become forest again and water and widening wilderness in that hour of inconceivable terror when you take back your name from all things. Just give me a little more time. I want to love the things as no one has thought to love them until they're real and ripe and worthy of you. I want only 7 days. 7 on which no one has ever written himself, 7 pages of solitude. There will be a book that includes these pages, and she who takes it in her hands will sit staring at it a long time until she feels that she is being held and you are writing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a great book.
I feel like our culture, I know that our culture doesn't teach us how to be held by God.
Right.
You know, we don't know how to sit still.
Right.
We don't know how to calm our thoughts so that we're open to receiving.
Right.
That's a real broad general statement, but, and we only know how to use our ego to sell our work. You know, and that's what our culture is all about. And for a person to create, you know, be a tool of God, it's very counterculture.
Right. There's so much that works against it.
Yeah.
Well, picking up on that, I think in one of your sessions you used the word something like commodification.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was just such a great term because a lot of times when you sit down now, it's with this idea that your journal is going to become the next New York Times.
Right.
It's almost like
right.
this pressure.
Right.
You have no idea, you know, it's not going to happen, but it's like that's what it has to be on the page in case someone ever discovers you. And that tremendous cultural, you know, force that's pressing in, one of the counters to that, I think, really opens up more creativity in Julia Cameron's book.
Yeah, right.
And where she says you get up in the morning and you write for like 15 or 20 minutes, 2 pages longhand,
right.
and then you stick those pages in a manila envelope.
Right.
And they're not meant to be for anyone other than you, and the technique is really to take off the foam, all the junk, all the subconscious stuff that's just cluttering, and you just pick it all up, write it down, and then you just stuff it in the envelope. And then you're much more receptive to the truly creative parts of yourself. And I can remember walking into a friend's home and on our dining room table she had a file and notebook and I said, are those your morning pages? And she immediately went, and you know, picked it up and grabbed it. And then I thought, good, because it was really raw and she didn't, it was private and she didn't want anyone to see that. And I see people in restaurants and in public parks and places. And it's like their lives are these journals all day long. And it's like, I have lost something that really put down my thoughts, like on the bus or in a library, I would just want to die. and so I think that's part of what the problem is, that nowadays when you do put pen to paper, you are putting your ego, and that's from a lot of social pressure.
Right. I think that's right. I think the academic analog of that, of course, is tenure, right? I mean, all our writing becomes geared toward job security. and so there isn't the space, well, there isn't the freedom to engage the kind of deep stuff that you're talking about, and there isn't space to do what Simone Weil commended to us on Thursday, which is there's a way of writing that makes you wait for the right word while you merely reject all inadequate words, you know. And that can take a long time. You know, as you're finding out, right? I mean, that can take a long time. And you might not have something to sell at the end of it. But I think that's exactly right. Resisting that commodification of, well, of any practice is so difficult. And I think the, you know, a place like this, like Holden Village, with a theme like the theme we're working with this summer, is an attempt to do that, to help us reclaim these very countercultural practices of creativity, of hospitality, of honoring our bodies in a way that's not commodified. That's right. But I think it's remarkably difficult to do, and we do sort of need to gather in places like this to get strength to do it. Anybody else? Something they're willing to say? Or a poem they're burning to read? Well, let's turn, I have just two more short pieces here I want to share with you. This next one, number four, is from the poet and essayist Wendell Berry. He's a farmer in Kentucky, and he writes a lot about, he has a book called What Are People For? He writes a lot about the environment, and he writes a lot about poetry. And this is an essay that he wrote on, it's called Poetry and Marriage, the Use of Old Forms, which is very, I think, you know, you can think of poetry in this way, you can think of marriage in this way, there are lots of other things you can think of in this way, is receiving old forms, when you join a form, joining all that form has ever joined. He talks in this essay about how, you know, sexual desire is very natural, language is very natural, but marriage is not, and poetry is not. You know, you're trying to put something that's natural into a form that is not, and the struggle of that. And so let me just read this short passage to you, and we can talk about it. He says, in marriage, as in poetry, the given word implies the acceptance of a form that is never entirely of one's own making. When understood seriously enough, a form is a way of accepting and of living within the limits of creaturely life. We live only one life and die only one death. A marriage cannot include everybody because the reach of responsibility is short. A poem cannot be about everything, for the reach of attention and insight is short. The second aspect of these forms is an opening, a generosity toward possibility. The forms acknowledge that good is possible. They hope for it, await it, and prepare its welcome, though they dare not require it. I think this is again what you were talking about. These two aspects are inseparable. To forsake the way is to forsake possibility. To give up the form is to abandon hope. There are, it seems, two muses, the muse of inspiration, who gives us inarticulate visions and desires, and the muse of realization, who returns again and again to say, it is yet more difficult than you thought. This is the muse of form. Properly used, a verse form, like a marriage, creates impasses, which the will and present understanding can solve only arbitrarily and superficially. These halts and difficulties do not ask for immediate remedy. We fail them by making emergencies of them. They ask rather for patience, forbearance, inspiration, the gifts and graces of time, circumstance, and faith. They are perhaps the true occasions of the poem, occasions for surpassing what we know or have reason to expect. They are points of growth like the axles of leaves. Writing in a set form, rightly understood, is anything but force and predetermination. One puts down the first line of the pattern in trust that life and language are abundant enough to complete it. Rightly understood, a set form prescribes its restraint to the poet, not to the subject. This is in a book called Standing by Words. I'm fascinated with discussions of form, because I think finding your form is the work of a lifetime. Some people find it very soon and give themselves to it, and others of us struggle with that. And perhaps you know this feeling of feeling that there is so much inside of you that you would like to express, but you're not sure exactly what your form is. Are you a teacher? Are you a pastor? Are you a writer? Are you a parent? Are you a lover? I mean, it's very, and of course, a balanced life, as Mark Twain would say,
our program director this summer, is what, you know, is more desirable than an unbalanced giving of oneself to only one thing. But I think that finding your form is our work in a way. And I think sometimes we pay too much attention to content and not to form. And he has some interesting things, I think, here to say about the forms of marriage, the forms of poetry. I think we could insert other forms here. Forms that have requirements. I mean, Christianity, right? I mean, there are practices that one is asked to give oneself to, forms of life that are not always easy to put ourselves into. I like his very expansive notion that there's, in giving oneself to a form, one is giving oneself in trust that life and language are abundant enough. If you know Wendell Berry's poetry, he writes in very formal structures. He writes sonnets, he writes in forms that you would recognize. And I like his line where he says, you know, putting down that first line, you're trusting that there's enough there, that the form is spacious enough, and that language is expansive enough to complete this one day. I mean, I'm thinking back on what, I'm sorry, could you tell me your name, the sonnet reader?
My name is Rosalie.
Thank you. I'm thinking back to what Rosalie said about, you know, the difficulty of waiting. And of being a writer, and writing, and how difficult it is to have that trust that life and language are abundant enough for you to do what you have in you to do. And I think it's very analogous to the Christian life in a lot of ways. There's much that's asked of us that we have to just kind of put the first line down and have trust that God is gracious enough, and our brothers and sisters forgiving enough, and the world graced enough that will do it. Any thoughts on Wendell Berry? Marriage, poetry, parenthood?
I'm one of those balanced beliefs.
Yes, good.
you know, I think that it's... it's something that's brought upon yourself as part of being human, mm-hmm. to think that you're waiting, mm-hmm. or you're looking towards a particular, quote, form, mm-hmm. of life, mm-hmm. the way I understand it, you're saying that. You know, if you're not writing and you're waiting, does that mean that you are not alive, or not producing, or not contributing, or not thinking, or not being a parent, not being that. Whatever it means. I mean, it seems that if, by what you read, it seems like if you're not in your form, you're in limbo. Anyone else hear that?
I'd like to respond to that, because I find that when I've been most creative is when I've been most unhappy. Mm. And that it's kind of a form of me working out and my spiritual life and my faith journey. And those things go on when I'm happy also. But I'm driven to write a song or a poem or those, you know, be more creative when I'm experiencing. Not when I'm, hey, things are great, you know? So I guess I'm, you know, it's kind of backwards for me. Creative, but I'm unhappy.
I'm saying is that wait.
Right, yeah.
To me, that doesn't seem a negative thing.
Well, I think what he's saying is that waiting, you are giving yourself to the form. That's part of being faithful to it. Our mistake is when we make emergencies of it, you know, in marriage or in poetry. Those periods of waiting that
I don't think he's saying that if you're not practicing your form in an active sort of way that you're not being faithful or you're not really but I think that's an important caution.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned earlier on just before or just after you read the section was that that we seek for a form. Some find it early, some find it late. But my contention is that is a construction.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
That might be unnatural.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I mean,
it's something that we
right.
have as humans. They have.
That's right. And that's
and that need to find a quote form is something that we constructed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people just fall into things. Some people search all their lives mm-hmm. for something. Well,
yeah.
I mean, so what?
I think he would agree with you. I think he would say that the definition of a form is that it's unnatural. And so there are these, so it poses all of these problems in trying to, you know, giving oneself to a form because it's so unnatural, because we have to kind of our way into it.
Well, I think that would be the parent. If you look in nature around it, parent is common.
Yeah.
What? Why shouldn't he?
Well, pairing and marriage, I think.
Yeah. Here we go. It's a definition. It's a construction. And that's what we have decided in language, how to describe it. So these problems that come up are just self-generated.
As opposed to generated by form.
The problems that forms create are, like I said, construction.
Well, let me go on to you.
I'd like to ask you all about the role of community
mm-hmm.
in creativity. So far, the readings have been very solid.
That's right.
The difference is for something that people do
only
alone.
That's right.
My experience is usually not.
Right.
So, I'd like to ask. Comment how helpful or unhelpful kinds of community
mm-hmm.
and fostering
mm-hmm.
Create that.
Mm-hmm. I think that's always a good critique of my approach to this because I do sort of think about these solitary people. But I think, as I said the other day, that the creative life, like the religious life, that it's made up of things we do together and things we do alone. The trouble comes, I think, in getting stuck in one or the other, you know, only being able to
yeah.
be with others or only being able to be alone. And I'm glad you brought that up because that's a very important corollary to all this. That really the work, I think, sometimes is finding paths between solitary work and communal living and communal work that we can travel with compassion and with love. Which seems to me easier in a place like this and more difficult in other places.
Yeah.
In a place like this where community is pursued with such faithfulness and love and concern for one another. But yeah, let me ask about that. The role of community in creative life. Tell me your name.
David.
As David points out, it's not simply the solitary genius box in her corner, right? Not just Marguerite Perret sitting silent in her cell. There are other forms of creative life.
Well, I've been actually struggling with that right now because I'm a paint and I need community. I feel like I need to go up into my garret and paint by myself for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then I need to come out and I need to have interaction with people and especially teach because I really enjoy doing that. But I'm finding that when I teach, I don't paint, and when I paint, I don't teach.
Mm-hmm.
And so the community aspect, it's like one or the other, and I don't know why, although I know I need to balance them, and I need both.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of where I'm working at. In fact, I
was teaching a couple weeks ago, and I went out to paint in the afternoon. Like my students did, and I got totally frustrated, you know, and had a terrible afternoon until I figured it out. I mean, it was just point blank. When I teach in the morning, I can't paint in the afternoon. Why is that? I don't know if anyone else experiences that kind of
thing. Oh, yeah. Well, writing and teaching, that's it. I tend to think that your energy, it's really a dumb, simplistic image, but it seems to make sense somehow that your energy can only flow in maybe one big direction at once, and you've expended it, and you need to gather up, you know, you've gotten a lot from your teaching, but maybe not immediate energy for writing and thinking. I find it possible to do that. Or if I do, I've had a double day, you know, and go on to the next one. I think that's perfectly normal. But the connections between them, there are these pathways or channels somehow. Through you, the things get connected. And those connections will inevitably come out in your, you know, in your teaching and your painting. Like you are like the conduit between them. And you reconnect the mysterious invisible.
I've been thinking about performance art, performance of art, because my daughter is a dancer. Both in the creation and in the performance, it's always a group process. And the performance depends on the audience,
part of
the performance.
Right.
So what's the role of an audience? Be one question. What kind of community is a good audience?
The community that says your voice is important, trust your voice, I hear you.
I think you this lady here, sorry I don't know your name, but I mean you described wonderful balance. Wonderful balance in two different ways. First here is that in these two informed, creative, contributing rotations, painting and teaching. And the other is this sense of community with the teaching and then the sense of being alone. You seem frustrated in describing it. I've been trying to support that. And again, my point of view is you seem a little frustrated about not being able to do both in the same way. It seems to take such great energy and concentration to do good work, either as a teacher or as a painter or in the community or alone.
And I think part of finding your form is finding the form of life that supports your best work. And, you know, the reconfiguring of things until you find what works. But I think you describe what many people feel. So there's very, very few people who can devote themselves full time to their creative pursuit. You know, when they come away. So I think it's precisely what you say, that this balance.